Coming to you live, yes, actually from Post 423 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. This is There I Was. This is our monthly podcast, open mic for veterans. This week's program is dedicated to the idea of what was your first duty station? Where did you go after you got done with AIT or wherever it was? My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be the host, which is always fun for me. I have a couple of announcements that I would like to get out there of upcoming events. Number one is Stories of Service is going to be coming up next week on the 6th of November, and this is to raise funds for the Fisher House. It's going to be at the Michigan Theater on November 6th at 7 p.m. All veterans and their families can get in free, first responders and so forth. There is a reception earlier, I think at 5:30. For more information, you can go to fisherhousemichigan.org/stories of service and find out more information. I also want to thank our sponsors here on Veterans Radio, and that would be Legal Help for Veterans. It's a disability law firm that handles disability claims. U.S. Wings down in Ohio, providers of the most fantastic military flight jackets ever, leather flight jackets. And we have a drawing coming up at the end of November in our benefits program for the Top Gun jacket that they've come out with to coincide with the debut, I guess you could say, of the new Top Gun movie. It's an $800 leather flight jacket. Pretty cool thing. So if you get an opportunity, you can go to our website, veteransradio.net, and click on the opportunity to register for that jacket. We need to have you register so that we can enter you in the drawing. And also we want to thank VFW Post 423, American Legion Post 46, and of course VVA Chapter 310, Charles S. Kettle's chapter, for their continuing support of Veterans Radio. We can't do it without your help. So thank you all very much. As I mentioned, There I Was is an open mic for veterans, and tonight we're going to be talking about our first duty assignments. And our first speaker, who is already up here, is Scott Brooks Miller, and Scott was in the Marine Corps. I won't hold that against him this time. But from 68 to 73, United States Marine Corps, he's got out of the service as a sergeant. So, Scott, you're on.
Well, good evening. My name is Scott Brooks Miller, and I did serve 5 years in the Marine Corps, four honorably and one questionable. When I finished track vehicle school in early 1969, my first duty station, because I was non-deployable as I was still 17, was the 4th Battalion, 13th Marines, located at Las Flores at Camp Pendleton. My MOS was 2144, track vehicle repairman for self-propelled artillery. So I go to my unit, and I'm there with a couple of other guys I went through track vehicle school with. And we made the transition to actually maintaining vehicles and working on guns that were going out with students and troops and driving around and getting all messed up and doing maintenance on them so that they could be used the next day or the next week, depending on the parts supply. The only thing that was interesting with my first duty station is that in April, we went on a convoy from Camp Pendleton to 29 Palms, California, at the Marine Corps Combat Center there, to practice for 4 weeks in desert warfare, as our unit was designated as one that would go to the Middle East if there were problems there. We camped out in the desert. We spent our evenings chasing rattlesnakes and putting them in ammo boxes and putting them in front of the tents of staff NCOs and officers. We learned to eat sea rations, and that's something you have to learn how to do because no sane person would ever do it on their own. We fired the guns a lot. Firing a 155 howitzer is, I guess, for lack of a better word, a thrill. I mean, it's fun. And I also learned during this time period never to stand in front of the gun when you fire it because the concussion, just you're deaf for hours. Actually, these guys put me up to it. I'm a sucker, so I did stand out in front. Never to be done again. We did have one weekend where Marine Corps Special Services drove us up to Las Vegas. Again, I'm 17. We just been paid. My usual paycheck without deductions was about $50 a month. I had an $18 savings bond taken out, so I had $32 in cash. And I arrive in Las Vegas, this $32 burning a hole in my pocket, knowing that I would make thousands upon thousands of dollars gambling. So within 30 minutes, I lose $22. And I very quickly learned that nobody really wins in gambling. So for the next 3 days, our rooms are paid for. In those days in Las Vegas, you could the food was free and the drinks were free as long as you were either playing at the tables or at a machine. And being 17, I was just practicing on becoming a drunk. So my favorite drink then was a whiskey sour. And these women were serving me whiskey sours. I had three or four the first night after I lost all my money. And I was going to marry, I was going to marry any one of these waitresses and take them away, and we were going to be happy the rest of our lives. And I was so disappointed. My friends dragged me back to the hotel, and I woke up, and the next morning, God, I could have been happy. It didn't work out that way, though. And then we go back to Camp Pendleton after four wonderful weeks in the high desert. Within 2 weeks, Staff Sergeant Nunnally, who is our platoon commander, sticks his head inside the driver's compartment of an M109 where I'm tightening up the engine mount, and he goes, "You've got orders." And my immediate response was, "I am not old enough." And he responded back to me, "But you will be." I had orders for Vietnam. I was going to turn 18 while I was home on leave. So I got that final 20-day leave. My birthday was July 4th. Turned 18, and by the 7th of July, I was back at Camp Pendleton at the staging battalion for my next adventure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Thank you very much. Any questions for Scott before he runs away? Well, Scott doesn't run anywhere right now, but no questions. All right. Thanks, Scott, very much. For some of us, our first duty stations were in where mine was, and probably some of the other ones here, was Vietnam. So I'll just jump right in with my little story here first for a second. Again, this is Dale. I graduated from flight school in November of 1968. They gave me 30-day leave. And before we left, we knew where we were going because we had all put in our wish list of where we were going to go be stationed. And I had put down Italy, Germany, Spain. I didn't care where it was, and then they all came back out of our graduating class of 100, I think it was 99, went to Vietnam. One guy went to Germany because he'd already been in Vietnam twice as an enlisted guy. So my friend Ray, we got together, and we met at Newark International Airport at the time, which was really just a big, giant hangar. And my wife was there, and his girlfriend at the time was there, and he had a bunch of letters because his girlfriend was a third-grade teacher, and all the kids had written really nice little letters to all of us wishing us good luck, that we would be fine, and they were praying for us to survive. So we flew from Newark to San Francisco, and when we got off the plane in San Francisco, a bus met us and took us to Travis Air Force Base. And when we got there, they said, "Oh, your orders have been delayed and the flights have been delayed and everything. You guys don't have to be here for three more days." And so they gave us some money. I think they were a lot more generous than the Marine Corps was. We got $300 each. And they said, "Come back in 3 days. There are advantages to being an officer." And so we went into San Francisco, and I'm not allowed to add, throw in all of the details that occurred there. So we went to Haight-Ashbury, of course. It was 1968, and Haight-Ashbury was the home of the hippie movement and everything else. We didn't quite fit in because our hair was a little shorter than most of the people, and we really didn't have any real clothes. So we had to go out. We went to a Salvation Army place and bought, a shirt and pair of pants so we could go up there. And we walked into this bar. And the woman, it was a topless bar, that we went into, and we went up to the bar itself, and the woman behind the bar, she said, are you guys going or coming? And we're going, we're going. She says, well, I had a feeling that you might be because your hair is short and so on and so forth. And she said, so you're not paying. And she immediately poured out, there were three of us, poured out these huge glasses of bourbon. It was, and much like Scott said, this was our, on-the-job training to become, to be a professional drinker, I think, is what it was. And the short version of the story is that we went from there to a number of other different places, and I woke up in Hawaii somehow 3 days later. But from there, we went to the 90th replacement. We flew from Hawaii, or we flew from San Francisco in a commercial airliner with real weight stewardesses and everything else. And we landed in Hawaii, then we landed in Guam, and I think we landed in Wake Island. It seems to me we made four stops before we started to go, landed at Tonsonut in Vietnam itself. And the pilot said something to the effect of, everybody look out the left side of the aircraft. Those lights that you see down there, that is Vietnam. And of course, as you looked out the window, not only did you see lights, but you could see explosions, you could see artillery going off, you could see rockets flying through the air, and you're going, this is probably not a good idea. We landed at Tonsonut, and of course the door opened and the proverbial oven opened up, and it was this rush of hot air, humid air, stinky air, and they said, okay, everybody off, everybody off. And everybody starts running, getting off the aircraft. And as you're coming down the steps that were out there, not like today, you had to go down the stairs. And as we're going down the stairs, these other guys that were all dressed in their jungle fatigues are running this way toward the aircraft, and we're walking down there. And they're all yelling at us to get off the darn aircraft, and we're walking by. And I think a local friend that we have here, Bill Ballou, left Vietnam on the day that I arrived, and he said, I think I saw you getting off the plane. Weren't you the one that was holding onto the door frame and wouldn't let go? And so I said, no, that was, I wish. So anyway, so from there we went, they put us on the bus, and it was a bus and it had barbed wire all around the windows and around the bus and everything else like that. And then they had a guy that looked like Rambo at the front of the bus and another Rambo at the back of the bus. And they drove us through the town of Benoit, and it was nighttime. It was dark, and it was an eerie thing. It was like a science fiction movie. I can't even explain what, but there were flashing lights, and it was raining, and it's just the worst scenario that you could imagine. And I looked out the window, and there are these people. There are children and women, and not too many men. And they're all looking up at the bus, and they had this look of like, we're going to get you, Yankee dog. And I'm going, there's been a mistake here. I'm sure there's been a mistake. And as we go through the town, you can hear these, again, noises going off all over the place and explosions. Drove over to the 90th replacement company, and they put all the off. The real officers went into one barracks, the warrant officers went into another barracks, and then the enlisted people were in another barracks. Well, I don't remember what it was exactly. Somebody's correcting me over there. But you were there before I was, because they could have built a high-rise, for all you know. And the next morning, they had this list attacked to the wall outside the barracks, and you went up there and you found your name, and mine said, okay, you're assigned to the 195th Assault Helicopter Company. Somebody will be here to pick you up shortly, because that particular base was really close by. And so I'm going, 195th, what the hell is that? But I was excited. And I was, this was my opportunity to actually utilize the skills that I had been taught to do. And that morning, a guy picks up in a Jeep, and he gets in, and he says, we're going to go back to the company area. And I said, oh, this is great. We drove for 10 minutes, and there we were. That was the company area. We were located in Long Bin. Right off, the 90th replacement was right off the edge of our runway. It was called Plantation Airfield, and we lived in barracks. Not traditional barracks, not the two-story barracks and so forth, but they were, walls went up about 5 feet, and then the rest was screen. And as you went in, they said, okay, you're the new guy. You get that corner over there which had, you know, none of the benefits. Some of the guys who had been there for a while had divided up their area, and they had wall lockers and fans hanging from the ceiling down on them and mattresses on their beds and so forth and so on. And so that was kind of my introduction to Vietnam. Met my commanding officer, and he assigned me to the 2nd Platoon. The call sign of our company was the Sky Chiefs. The platoon's nickname or call sign were the Ghost Riders, and that was the beginning of the end for me. Before we could get out and start flying missions, we had to do a check ride. We had to get a check ride and get approved that we could still fly and so forth. And there are many more stories, because within that first week of being in Vietnam, I witnessed my first crash and got to see my first casualties of war. But other than that, it was a pretty exciting time, and I was really geeked to get ready to go, because I realized that I was there to accomplish a mission, and it was really turned out to be a lot more of an important mission than I ever imagined. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Any questions? Yes, sir. Some people, they told us, were a little bit nervous as far as I know you always like these stories, but we had to demonstrate that we could handle emergency situations. And so one of the tasks that we had to do is called a hydraulic failure. And part of the hydraulic failure, for those that have cars, you know, when your power steering goes out, multiply that times 10, and all the controls, you couldn't move them hardly at all. And you had to adjust your RPMs on the engine to compensate so that you could keep the aircraft straight and so on and so forth. And so we ended up having to do a running landing in a helicopter, which is normally you come to a hover and you just go wherever it is that you want to go. But this, you actually acted like an airplane, and you would come down and hit the ground and just skid across it until you finally stopped. It was always a big adventure, because we would land on that, whatever that metal was, PCP. Yeah. And so you would have sparks flying out all over the place. It kind of looked like 4th of July. but I survived and did my hydraulic failure and a couple of auto rotations, so that if we, you know, you got shot down, you could possibly get to the ground safely. And next thing you know, check, 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 and off I go to fight the war. The question is, how is a aviation company set up? There were three platoons, three pilot aviation platoons. There were two slick units and one gunship platoon. And the slicks were, the first platoon, second platoon, and then the gunships, they were the thunder chickens. There was also a headquarters company. Yeah, there was, you know, handled all the administrative stuff. Each platoon, if I remember right, we had 10 aircraft in each platoon. And then they had, there was a maintenance platoon as well that did all of the maintenance on the aircraft. And they would, the aircraft had to be, they had a 25-hour checkup, sort of like an oil change sort of thing on your car, and then they had a 100-hour where they did a major thing. They broke down the engine and then put it back together again. We had the question was, that we have a checklist that we followed. Yes, when we started the aircraft every time for the first time every day, we did have a checklist that we went through. Although eventually we weren't supposed to, but we did memorize it. You know, turn the battery on, clear everything, make sure the blade was untied. That was always a big one. I saw a helicopter try to start one time with that. it pulled itself around in a circle almost. But there was a certain sequence that you had to go through to get the thing started. And since it was a turbine engine, it didn't start right away. It would kind of, you'd hear this whining sound. For those of you ever heard one start up, you know, it's kind of wee. And then you hear a little bit of a psh. That's when it ignites. And when we would do a land out in the boonies somewhere, and sometimes they would tell us to shut them down, which we really weren't in favor of, but you know, you'd do it anyway. We could get it started pretty quick, because when we were at some of our missions, they had us where we had to be able to be airborne in less than 3 minutes. Definitely those guys. And the thing about the maintenance crews were so young. I mean, we were all young. I mean, as I look out at our audience, you know, we're all in our 70s now. And at that time, somebody 18, 19 years old was responsible for $1 million aircraft. And not only was he responsible for it, but he flew in it. because the crew chiefs would fly with us all the time. And every day, and I didn't really realize this until I was done, I would come in at the end of the day, sign off the sheet, how many hours we flew and all this other stuff, and walk away. They stayed there and cleaned everything up. You know, if we'd carried casualties and stuff, they would wash out the aircraft and so forth. And then he would do his maintenance check to make sure everything else. So he would usually be down there another at least hour and a half, 2 more hours after we were done. I mean, they were just amazing. Such talented young men. And we as pilots really did appreciate them. And we owed our lives to them more than once. And we would try to train them how to fly. At least land. That was a big one right there. Okay? All right. So we'll move right along. Thanks, guys. You're listening to Veterans Radio's monthly There I Was open mic for Veterans Night. And tonight we're talking about our first duty stations. And so next up is whom, Larry? So we've got Larry and St. Antoine. Larry was a Navy CB. And his story is going to be a little bit different because CBs went in and out of Vietnam at 6, 8, 9 months.
Seems like nine months.
Rotations, and so he had a number of different tours. So, Larry, you're on.
I joined my battalion right around the 1st of September when they were back for after their first tour in 65, 66. I went to Class A school to get my training for my MOS, and while I was in A school, my battalion left for their second tour. And when I graduated from A school, like Dale, I had to fly over commercial to join my battalion. And it was like November. The Navy has a funny thing about you have to wear special uniforms at special times of the year. And at that time, it was wool blues. And I was flying commercial, so I couldn't wear my jungle outfit, which was neat, but I had to wear wool blues. We were getting close to Da Nang, and over the radio comes, everybody get out of their seats and get ready to deplane as fast as possible. Da Nang's being hit with mortars. And so we're flying in, and like Dale said, when they opened the doors, I think it was 120 degrees out there, we went running down the ramp, and there were guys running toward us to leave, happy and saying, suckers, have fun, good luck. I caught the same kind of bus that Dale caught with screens on the side so no one could throw a bomb in there or blow you up. I got to my base camp in at the foot of Freedom Hill and checked in with my company commander to give him my orders and set up what I need. And he called in a first-class petty officer, and he says, take Larry to this hooch and show him where he's at, and then put him to work. I'm going, I just got off the plane. You're putting me to work already. He says, well, you can take your blouse off, which was the wool upper part. They put me up in the ceiling of a building of an officer's club with those wool pants on. It must have been 300 degrees up there. I think my legs got thinner by the inch while I was up there. That was my first experience in Vietnam, my first duty station. We went on to, we had 9 months there, the first tour. We went on to build the Liberty Bridge, which was the longest wooden bridge in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. We built a lot of camps, Kaesan, Khon Tien, Dong Ha, mostly in I Corps. We took care of the roads. We built most of the Marine camps. I was stationed for over a week in, up in Kaesan, working up there, and that was quite an experience. But, you know, that was my first duty station, the first tour over there. My second duty station in 68 was my second tour over there. So a lot different than my first choices of Hollyglock, Scotland, and Rota, Spain. And it was quite an experience. But Seabees had a lot of fun. We were all together, which was unlike any of the other branches. So we went over together, and we came back together, hopefully. And that's my story. And I'll stick by it, too.
Yep, well, you're the expert on it, right?
Oh.
Repeat the question for her.
Tour 2 was an experience because instead of 9 months, we did 11 months because we were back about two to three weeks for our 3 months replacing equipment and people. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, we get a call in our apartment that Ted had started. Pack your seat bag. You're on a plane tomorrow going back to Vietnam. So we went 2 months early. And the plane flight was something. We left Port Hueneme, and we went to Adak, Alaska. It was 30 below, and we had to deplane in an unheated building for about 2 hours, which was fun. And then we had to spend 15 hours in Okinawa when they had trouble with the plane. So it was like a 24-hour flight the second time. Commercial, we went straight there. Yeah. 20-some-hour flight. We did land in Hawaii, too, but because we were all in uniform and with weapons, we couldn't go anywhere. So that was an experience. But, yeah, the second tour, the first tour was 66, 67, was kind of rough, but the second tour during Tet was really rough. Yeah. And especially when you're there 2 more extra months where you didn't expect to be there. I think my total time was 1 year, 11 months, and 28 days in Vietnam.
You were how old when you were the first time?
I was, in 66, I was 20. I was old.
And then when you went back again, you were 22?
We went back and, no, 21. Oh, okay. Yeah, about 21. And when I got out, I was 20. Well, the battalion, my battalion went back 4 times.
You yourself?
Me, 2 times. So I didn't have as much as some of the other guys. You know, there were some battalions went back 6 times. So.
You think that this time?
Well, you always think that, but we're so young and stupid. We didn't think. As long as you had a beer in your hand in the evening, you didn't think too much. And you know, I think the Seabees probably had the least amount of KIAs than any branch, and I'm using the Seabees as a branch, which no one says they are. But I think that one of the reasons we found out, one thing we found out was, as long as we were building roads and building infrastructure, they left us alone. If we were building bases and airstrips, that's where we were the most at danger, because they knew that if when we left, the roads would be there after we built them, and the bridge would be there. You know, so I mean, out of the 2 years I was there, my battalion lost 10 guys, KIA, a lot wounded, but, you know, we were lucky. I mean, we worked all day outside the base every day. It's not like, I know some guys went out for a month or two and then come back. We were out every day away from the base. We had stat teams of 13 guys that went all over the country by themselves. Hopefully that, the villagers would protect them or stuff like that. But, yeah, it was interesting. A lot of, you know, but we had the Marines protecting us, so that was good. And we used to steal all our equipment from the Air Force because they had everything new. Oh, yeah.
They did.
To Da Nang Air Base in the middle of the night with a truck and come back with a generator, brand new, never used. And they never missed it because they had 8 or 9 of them sitting there. Then we paint it. Put a CB on it.
So. You just change the serial numbers on it and put your look.
We didn't
put your look.
Do that. We just painted it over. No one ever stopped us. You know.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Larry. I'm looking up these numbers here. Casualties by branches is what I'm trying to do here. And I got the Navy. Out of the 58,000, the Navy lost 2,556. The Army lost 38,179, Marines 14,836, and the Air Force 2,580. That was 1% of the strength in Vietnam for the Air Force, 2% of the Navy, 5% of the Marines, and 2.7% of the Army.
It's hard to use the Navy because you're talking about the flotillas, and they never, you know, the amount that were on the coast were never really in that much danger, where the total of Seabees in Vietnam were at one time were 27,000. So probably the percentage of those KIA would be Seabees. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I could probably, at some point, maybe we'll look it up by specialty or MOS and see how that one shows up. But
the one thing about the Seabees in Vietnam, we had our only Medal of Honor winner.
Recipient.
In Vietnam. So.
Recipient. You don't win the Medal of Honor. You know that.
Well, he was fighting real hard to win something.
Yeah, he was fighting to win another day on Earth.
Yeah.
All right.
But that's it.
All right. Thank you, Larry, very much. The comment from the peanut gallery was just now is that radio operators had about 15 seconds after they keyed the mic before somebody would take a shot at them. Or he called it an airstrike or an artillery attack, you know. That would be it. Now, of course, we've got a couple of artillery people in there. All right, we were listening to Open Mic Night here. There I was. We're talking about our first assignments outside of after we completed our training. Who is next? Bob? Okay. So we've got our Air Force person now. This is Bob Kurtz. Bob was in the Air Force for 20 years, 1971 to 91, and left the service as an E-6. That's a tech sergeant?
Yep.
Okay. Bob Kurtz, welcome back.
All right.
And welcome home. It's good to have you.
I was really lucky as I went to my training to be a forward air controller. Everybody that graduated went to Vietnam, 30 guys off to Vietnam. So I figured that's where I would go. But it's just like Dale, you already knew where you were going to go. And about 2 weeks before I left, I'm going to Spain. And my dream sheet, I put Vietnam. If you're going to send me to Vietnam, I might as well want to go to Vietnam. So that's what I put on my dream sheet. Of course, I never, ever got anything I put on my dream sheet, even after 20 years. How nice. So when they say it's a dream sheet, that's exactly what it is, a dream sheet. So in the Air Force, it's really great. They expect you to go to travel. They'll give you tickets for your next assignment, and you go there, and they tell you what to do. You'll find there's a lot of people to tell you what to do in the military. If you don't like being told what to do, don't join the military, that's for sure. But some of us during the Vietnam years, we didn't have too much of a choice. It's either join the military or go to jail. And I didn't like those choices. But anyway, I'm going to Spain. Hey, great, I'm not going to Vietnam. I went down to travel. I get on a plane out of New Jersey. I forget what that place was. But anyway, and I would pick up a fight, and I'd be in Spain. Seville, Spain, that's where I was going. Beautiful base. That's the base where they dropped off a couple of nukes off the coast of Spain. Franco closed the place. I get there. There's a lock and key on the gate. I was not briefed as to what to do when you get to your duty station and nobody's there. I'm on a Navy base. I'm in Rota, Spain. I talk to the Navy, and the Navy says, we don't talk to Air Force personnel. Hit the road, Jack. And that's the truth. They did not talk to us. There was two other guys with me. I should have known something was fishy when there was only three Air Force guys on the commercial flight to Rota, Spain. Everybody else looked a little fishy, like Navy. Yeah, that was great. So here's the three of us standing on the corner on Rota base, looking like three bumps on a log. This nice Air Force guy stopped. He said, what are you guys doing? And we said, we don't know what we're doing. We're just standing here, you know, wondering what to do. Well, none of us were briefed. This is our first assignment, you know, and the darn base is closed. So he says, well, what you have to do is go to the nearest base in Spain. And, of course, we didn't know what the nearest base in Spain was. I knew there was a base maybe in Madrid or something, but that's a long distance from where we are. So he takes us to a base called Morón Air Base. It was spelled Moron, but they pronounced it Morón. So, of course, I get there, and so do these other two guys. They didn't know what to do with us. We arrive unexpected. We don't have a duty assignment there. So they put us up in the officers' quarters. Well, how nice. 2 weeks. It was like 2 weeks' leave. Anyway, what they decided was is they'd put us to work, you know, because we can't just live in officers' quarters. I could have. It was really nice. Maid service and everything. So we get into the barracks. They made me a telephone operator, a switchboard operator. That's what I was. So for 3 months until I got my first assignment, I was a telephone operator on a Spanish switchboard. Oh, yeah, and I'm working alone, too. I don't speak a word of Spanish. Needless to say, I started talking with some gal. She was an operator in Seville, and I would call her up when I had somebody going. Of course, I couldn't understand what they were saying, and so I'd patch her into this person, and then she'd tell me what number to dial. Yeah, that was great. So I finally get my assignment. My first duty assignment, I'm going to northern Greece. Greece? What do they got there, you know? I didn't think we even had troops in Greece. But anyway, getting ahead of myself, I'm still in Rhodes. No, I'm in Morón Air Base. Every day I go to base ops and ask, is a plane coming in? Because there's only 35 people on this base. It's like a skeleton crew. So I'm going to base ops. I get to base ops. Base ops would say, no plane in today, Mrs. Airman Kurtz. You have to wait till a plane comes in. 10 days I waited for a plane to come in. One did come in about 5 days waiting. It was a Learjet. There was a general on board, and he said to the crew, no airman will aboard this plane. And that meant me. So about 5 days later, a C-130 comes flying in, and this colonel comes up to me and says, I understand you guys are going to Madrid. I have this package I want you to hand carry. Okay, so he takes my name. I'm on my way to my first assignment. We get to Madrid, and the darn plane, the landing gear won't come down. Well, what kind of deal is that? We circled Madrid. I often wanted to see Madrid, but not at 10,000 feet, you know. We're circling Madrid. We even put a guy on a tether to try and kick the landing gear down off that plane. Well, it came down halfway. Halfway is worse. Now we're in worse shape. The C-130 has two rows of wheels. Only one row came down, and then it only came down halfway, and the other wouldn't come down at all. And because Madrid doesn't have any facilities to repair planes, we flew all the way to Mildenhall, England to crash. Took us 5.5 hours. There are more holes in that plane than you can imagine. There's 6 exits on the ceiling alone that you can get out. And we went through emergency landing procedures like crazy. It was 5 hours of nothing but going through emergency landing procedures. Don't run into the propeller. We ran out of fuel when we hit the runway. That propeller wasn't even going around when the plane came to a stop. They foamed the runway. They knew we were coming hot. You know, oh, we got a plane coming in hot. Yeah, foamed the runway. Well, the wind's blowing the wrong way. We weren't on that runway more than 2 seconds, and we were digging a hole in the median. That plane caught on fire, and I ran from that plane as fast as I could. Nothing like running away from a burning plane. This is my first military flight. How sweet. No.
No, we hadn't even reached that yet.
No. I'm in England. I'm supposed to go to Greece. You know how far England is from Greece? Yeah. So the landing gear was, well, the landing was successful. Okay. Anytime you survive
that's a good crash,
that's a good landing. We were lucky we didn't cartwheel. That was would have been it. Because we stayed level, digging up the median, and we didn't come to any taxiway, in which that's what usually catapults the plane into destruction. That didn't happen. So there's another plane leaving for Germany, and they get us on it. And it only took us about 2.5 hours, but we had a mayday on this plane. We had emergency landing in Germany. We had lightning hit our plane, and it blew a big hole in the tail. I mean, big enough you could put a person through it. And they tell me, oh, planes don't get hit by lightning. Don't believe it. When you see a hole in your tail section, yeah, really great. So I'm a little hesitant about getting on another plane. But I did, and I arrived in Athens, Greece, 3 o'clock in the morning, hit a 100-degree already at 3 a.m. in the morning. You get off the plane, and there you are. And this plane, he lets us off in the middle of the runway. So there I am. I'm standing in the middle of the runway with my duffel bag and a briefcase. And this security patrol guy comes up and says, what are you doing out here? And I go, well, you see that plane as he's taxiing away? That plane just dropped me off here. He says, well, you can't be here. And I says, well, where am I supposed to go? And he points to this light. I can see it. It's about 2 miles away. He says, that's where you're supposed to go. And he starts to take off. I says, hey, wait a second. Aren't you going to give me a ride? I couldn't believe it. He expected me to walk over there. Well, he finally said, well, I'm not supposed to give anybody a ride, but go ahead and hop on. So there I am. I'm in Athens, and I'm supposed to be at a site in northern Greece. And when I went to the base ops there in Athens, where our headquarters was, why, they hadn't even heard of the site that I had on my orders. They say, this site doesn't even exist. And I'm going, well, this is great. First I get assigned to a closed base. Now I'm assigned to a base that doesn't exist. How sweet.
I think we're going to have to stop there.
Well, anyway, we're going to stop here because I've talked too much. That's what radio operators do. Are there any stupid questions?
There are no. I don't know about I'm wondering about the personnel department in the Air Force, though. Okay, so right now we got a new person. All right, so I don't want to mess this up. So we've got Jim Gibbons is coming up here to talk to us. He's also an Army veteran. He was in the military from 1969 to 72. And when he got out, he was an E-4. So, Jim, welcome to There I Was.
Well, thank you. My last AIT was at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and it ended sometime in January of 1970. And I had about a week and a half home leave to get everything in order. And then I flew to Fort Dix. And while we were at Fort Dix, we changed into our jungle fatigues, and here we're standing in formation in 20-degree weather in jungle fatigues and no jackets or coats. So when the word finally came down, we were bused to Travis Air Force Base, and from there, I remember we flew into Honolulu Airport, and they kept us in one corner, and while they gassed up the plane, and our next stop was Guam, and then all I can remember was Benoit Air Base, and again, they opened the door, and like someone mentioned earlier, the blast of hot air, even at 10, 11 o'clock at night, hit us with all the humidity and the smell. So they bussed us on that green Army bus with the bars across all the windows to Long Bend, the replacement depot, and they dropped us off, and we're standing on this tennis court, and I'm looking out in the distance in these two-story wooden barrack buildings. I see little blue screens, and they happen to be TV sets. And I said, I thought this was a war. I'm standing on a tennis court, and I see televisions. What's going on? Somewhere along the line, we changed our money to military NPC, and after several days at a replacement depot, I was finally flown by C-130 aircraft to Cu Chi, Vietnam, which was about 30 miles northwest of Saigon. And from there, I was delivered to my new duty station, which was 725th Maintenance Battalion. I ended up in Delta Company. And that was basically right around February 8th, because I spent a total of 10 months exactly there. I ended up going home December 8th, 1970. So I was there. My MOS was 63 Charlie 20, which was track vehicle mechanic. I was also a heavy truck mechanic. So I had gone through two AITs. And when I ended up getting over there, I didn't use either one. I was in a third echelon battalion where we would switch out the engine, transmission, whatever part of the vehicle, and replace it with a new item and send it back to the unit it belonged to. Several months later, we ended up, when President Nixon invaded Cambodia, we ended up just a few kilometers from the Cambodian border. We ended up on this huge fire support base, and we had infantry companies on R&R kind of guard our end of the support, the fire support base. Somewhere along the line, for about 2 weeks straight, Charlie was throwing mortars at us every day at 5 p.m., or pardon me, 6 p.m., while we're lining up for evening chow. So that was my extent of combat. Of course, we were all scared to death, not knowing where to hide or what to hide under. But we all survived, and my unit went back to Hawaii. Later on, December 1970, I went home for 30 days and ended up in southern Germany.
Well, that's not fair.
Well, I was really in my artillery battery, which was a company-sized unit. I was only one of maybe four or five in the whole battery that had a unit patch on our right sleeve. Everybody else who was there in Germany only had the current unit patch on their left sleeve. So some of us looked at us like we were strange or maybe lucky to be there in Germany. In fact, I had our battery commander, a captain, was jealous of me and my green dress uniform, that I had more ribbons and more patches on my dress uniform than he did.
They didn't like that.
And the first sergeant standing next to him just rolled his eyes in disgust, because he'd already been there several times. Of course, I'd been there. We're thinking, you have no idea, sir. But we left it alone at that.
That's true. When you were in Cu Chi, you were a mechanic there?
I was a mechanic. Yeah. We were all 63 Charlie track vehicle mechanic, but we ended up working mostly on the 2.5-ton, 5-ton truck. And the mechanized infantry units would bring in their they wouldn't bring that vehicle in, but they'd bring the power pack in, and we would split it apart and put a new engine to it or a new transmission, whatever they needed. And then they'd pick it up and put it back in their vehicle. We did that a lot, and that's kind of how we kept ourselves busy, was doing all that work and, you know, the god-awful heat. And then at night it dropped to 80 degrees, and we felt like we were freezing. We'd roll our sleeves down.
Yeah. No,
stay warm. I mean, after all that oppressive heat and humidity during the day, 100 degrees and probably darn near that much humidity.
I thought it was kind of unusual at night that you did have to actually sleep under your poncho liner or something along those lines, or actually, dare I say, sheets, to stay warm. Yeah. I don't know what it was, but it was cold. I mean, I remember that. But, I was going to ask you about, we'll ask you about Cu Chi next time.
Well, you know, I slept between two white sheets with an Army-issue wool blanket that said U.S. on it. And I woke up every morning when I didn't have a god-awful guard duty the night before. I woke up with a wool blanket on top of me every morning in Vietnam. Of course, we were in the Florida portion of Vietnam. Or was it Haiti? Well, one of the two.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Great
job. Tell us his adventure. This is John Kinzinger, and John was in the service from 66 to 68. And when he got out of the Army, he was an E-4, and he was a radio operator in Vietnam. So, John, you're on.
AIT. I must start there. I did 7 weeks of AIT after basic in radio school at Fort Knox, learning Morse code. Somewhere along the line of my testing, they thought I must have been good at it. Then they sent me to Fort Gordon, Georgia for 11 weeks of Morse code typing, and I became a radio teletype operator. Radio teletype units need air conditioning. There were 48 of us in my AIT class, and 16 of us got orders for Vietnam. One of the most memorable things that happened right before I left was a good friend I developed from Corpus Christi, Texas, a Latino young guy, Samuel Berrientes, came to me one night, tears in his eyes, and he said, "You're going to Vietnam?" "Yes." He said, "I want you to take this with you to keep you safe." I said, "Okay." He gave me a necklace that had a St. Christopher on it, and 52 years later, I still wear that chain. Thank you, Samuel. So here I am. I'm going to Fort Dix, New Jersey. I'm thinking, oh, man, I got orders to go to the 27th signal. I'll be in Saigon with air conditioning. That's not going to be too bad at all. Okay, so I did the Fort Dix to Anchorage to Yokota, Japan to Saigon flight in a C-141. I had never seen a plane that big in my damn life. I mean, it had wings that went forever, and, oh, it was like a large coffin is what it was like. There were maybe 150 of us sitting backwards in this plane that had like lawn chairs that we sat in. There's no sound deadening in those planes, and the noise was so loud you couldn't talk to the guy next to you. So what you had was about 24 hours of thinking about Vietnam, because what you left at home was not something you were going to see for a long time. So honestly, on that flight, I got to thinking, well, yeah, I am going to be a radio teletype operator. What about those medical instructions they gave you about sucking chest wounds and things like that? Now, let's go through those in your mind, you know. So I'm going through all that. We stopped in Anchorage, Alaska, and I got my first taste of what Air Force life was like. We got off our plane, went in and had chow in an Air Force dining hall. My goodness, it was the nicest place I'd ever eaten. And I went in and I saw some of the rooms that the guys had. There were two guys to a room. My goodness. We didn't have anything less than 30 or 40 in the bays I'd been in. Back on the plane, we landed in Long Bend or Saigon Airport, Thompson, and like everyone else, you know, the tail end of the plane opened up, and the flush of hot air and a rank smell of rotten vegetation and fecal matter or whatever it was will never leave my mind. Okay, I'm here. You know, so we unboarded, and we got an Ed bus with the old cyclone fencing across the windows. That was kind of a wake-up call. Gee, this is not a nice area. Why would anybody ever just throw a grenade or something in here? I'm just a little old, just turned 20-year-old kid that hadn't been out of Belleville. And now I've got me 10,000 miles away, and I want to yell, "Mama." Well, that wasn't so bad. I go to the 90th replacement. Oh, by the way, at the Saigon Airport, some guy told myself and a few of the other guys that I've been traveling with, just put your bags over there in our cart. We'll make sure they get to you. Hell, that was the last time I saw those. So for about 7 days, I wore those khakis that I was wearing at the 90th replacement with nothing else. So there was some relief when we were called out for formation. And what they do is they'd say, okay, all of you, the following, fall out over here. You're going to this unit. I'm thinking, 27th signal. I got it made. I'll just wait here. All the following, fall out over here. You're going to the 1st Cavalry Division. They called my name. I said, oh, shit. Must be a mistake. Well, there was no mistake. So they put me on a, I don't know, 123 or something, flew me up to Anh K. Anh K was the division base camp. So then I'm still thinking, well, maybe they got radio teletypes there, you know. So I went from the replacement center there in Anh K, and they sent me to one of the perimeter units. It was the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. I'm still hoping there's air conditioning. So they sent me to the commo tent. I met a couple of guys who have been there for quite a while. They were back in the rear area. They were getting ready to rotate out, and I just asked them. I said, you guys got teletypes? Where in hell are they? He said, see those two cases over there in the corner? That's where our teletypes are. Well, see, the battalion was allocated heads for having a teletype system, but there's no way in heck you could use it over there. So there I was, And they gave me a Brick 25 and said, you're going off forward with the a battalion, and you're going to be an RTO. Okay, so I still don't know quite what I'm getting into.
What's an RTO?
It's a radio telephone operator. And right next to us at our battalion camp there in Nan Kay, we had a commo tent. Next to it was the medic tent. So I got to talk to, before I went forward and got, you know, I got all my gear and stuff and they sent me forward, I got to talk to one of the medics that was going home, had received a Silver Star from the previous engagement the unit was in. And I'm thinking, oh my, mama, this, what am I doing here? So anyway, I went out forward and I was very fortunate. The unit had been decimated in a couple of battles, beginning with Idrang Valley, and then they had a major battle at Bong Song 6 months later, and the battalion was separate from the division for about 18 months. I happened to have 12 months in the middle of it, and I was just very blessed. But that's my experience. There's lots more details, but that's my story, and I'm going to stick to it.
Terrific.
Never saw a teletype.
No teletyping, right? No teletyping. That's not fair. So that ends another one of our versions of There I Was here on Veterans Radio. So we want to make sure that you come out next month, November 20th, at the VFW 423 on the South Wagner Road in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We hope to see you here. We'll let you know what the topic's going to be, probably something along the lines of what was the most surprising event in your military career, wherever you may happen to be. So we want to thank you all again for listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be back. Until then, you are dismissed.